to read Back to Reality, the best-selling novel of the Bestseller Experiment by the two Marks, go to bestsellerexperiment.com/back to reality.
And subscribe to this podcast to get loads of extra bonuses. Go to bestsellerexperiment.com/subscribe. Let's run the show.
Hello and welcome to the Bestseller Experiment, where we continue to discover what makes a best-selling novel. And before we splash into the lapping waves of this week's episode, I want to give a big thank you to our sponsor, Scrivener. Scrivener is the official writing app of the Bestseller Experiment. It's the app that Mr. DeVoe and I use to write our Kindle bestseller, Back to Reality. And we love it, and we think you should get it a bit cheaper than everyone else, you know, because we like you and because we like that. And so we went to Scrivener and said, hey, how about giving our friends a few pennies off? And they said, we can do better than that. 20% off. 20% off Scrivener to you, dear listener. If you pop over to literatureandlatte.com and put in the exclusive listener code BESTSELLERXP. Good luck with that. I'll tell you what I've been doing with Scrivener recently. Now, my fantasy novel, The End of Magic, which is fully funded on Unbound, so thank you for that. You can still pre-order it. I didn't write that in Scrivener because I wrote it before we started doing the podcast, and I had to put it on one side while we were doing the first year of our podcast and writing Back to Reality. But what I've done, coming back to it, I've taken all the piddly bits of research that I did, all the little notes I ever made, all the ideas I had for sequels, all the notes on characters and locations and who's related to who and blah, 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 blah. I've put it all into one Scrivener document. It took me about an hour and a half. It's all in there now. It's all in one place. So when I'm rewriting, when I'm taking editorial notes, when I'm thinking about sequel ideas, I don't have to walk into a room that looks like a breeze has just blown through it. It's all neatly put away. And that's one of the things I love about Scrivener. It's adaptability. It's just fantastic. So check it out. And a big thank you to everyone who's been in touch on social media recently, not least my little Knickerbocker glory debate. Now, I was writing a screenplay recently, and I was introducing my protagonist, and I wanted to get across the idea that she was fun and vibrant when everyone else around her was kind of dull. So I said, you know, if we're all vanilla, she's a Knickerbocker glory. And then it occurred to me that not everyone might know what a Knickerbocker glory is. I think it's a very British thing. So I put word out there online, and thank you to everyone who came back to me and basically proved me right, because I think anyone outside of Britain didn't know. I think we had one New Yorker who knew what a Knickerbocker glory was, but everyone else did not. So, of course, a Knickerbocker glory is an ice cream sundae. So I changed it because I figured, you know, especially with TV scripts, they go out to America. That's where a lot of the money can come from. So you don't want to throw and lose your reader on the first page. So I changed it to Ice Cream Sundae, which still works and still works really, really well. So thank you, everyone, for that bit of feedback there. The internet still has its uses. And thanks to a lot of our listeners for getting in touch and putting stuff out there. One of our regular listeners, Edward Kane, who is at Nihilis, N-Y-A-L-I-S-S, on Twitter, he wrote a really interesting blog called On Crafting a Story. He's been writing a short story and a novel that he's working on. But he goes back in and he asks the basic question, what is a story? And I always think it's always really good to get back to basics on something like that. So check out Ed's website. It's edwardkane.me, and he wrote it on the 24th of May, On Crafting a Story. Great to see another debate sparked by one of our regular listeners, Bethany Swafford, asking about quotes and reviews from other authors on the back of a book or on the product description of your book on Kindle. What difference does it make? How effective is it? So, and you know, a lot of people find them useful, but I think very much less is more, you know. And how do you get those quotes? And it's Bethany is at Swafford Bethany on Twitter. So try and follow that. That was a fascinating debate. And if you have any thoughts on quotes from other authors on top of your blurb on the back of a book, let us know about them. Another one of our regular listeners, Tuvia Pollack, who's at Tuvia Pollack. Tuvia is going away tomorrow for a writing weekend. Just me, a hotel room, a computer with Scrivener, and a pile of useful source material for my historical fiction. So Tuvia is basically locking himself away in a room. And I tell you what, these are some quite heavy books, you know. There's A Day in the Life of Ancient... He's put a photo up on Twitter, A Day in the Life of Ancient Rome, The Essential Guide to Writing a Novel, and some books in Hebrew, which I have no chance of understanding. But yeah, good luck with that, Tuvia. Let us know what happens when you come out the other end. and what kind of book have you got? Congratulations to a friend of the podcast, Michael R. Miller, who's written a fantastic fantasy novel called The Dragon's Blade, and he's finally got that number one bestseller, Orange Flash, on Amazon. So we're really delighted to see that with Michael. He's helped us out when talking. He's never been on the show. We've spoken to him a couple of times, sort of off record, about things like Amazon advertising and Facebook advertising, because he's really good at this stuff, and I would like to get him on one day. But yeah, congrats, Michael. It's about blooming time. Now, on to this week's special guest, and I was delighted to get in touch with an author called Julie Wasmer, who lives just up the road from me, basically, in a beautiful part of the world called Whitstable. You may recall we've already had a Whitstable author on the show with Catherine May, whose book, The Electricity of Every Living Thing, is out now. Do check it out. And there is something about Whitstable that does tend to attract artistic, creative types. It's a hotbed of art and creativity and writers down there. Julie is, she's an East Ender who wrote for EastEnders. She was born in the East End of London, went on to write for, you know, the most popular TV soap in the UK. And she's now written a series of crime novels, the Whitstable Pearl Mysteries, which feature a character called Pearl Nolan. And what we decided to do, because it was a lovely day, we weren't just going to do an interview in some stuffy room. We went to the seaside. We went and sat by the sea. We have a really fun conversation. We talk about the importance of location in fiction, the problems when it comes to writing about local people. If you write about, you know, the place where you live, we talk about how to keep a series character fresh, how she broke into TV and what she learned on EastEnders, and why you should live in fear of a cup of tea and a bacon sandwich. So here's how that conversation went down. Julie, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm absolutely fine, Mark, and it's a brilliant day, so it's a really great day to be having a conversation on the beach.
The beach. We're here on Whitstable Beach, which I know quite well because I've been here quite a few times. Got some friends here. I live not too far that away, east, near a sort of Herne Bay way. It is a lovely part of the world, very relaxing. But you've decided to start bumping off the locals. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I have. It's kind of become a bit like a coastal midsummer in many ways. And there are quite a few of the locals who are getting very worried, you know, if I spend more than 5 minutes talking to them lately. But yeah, I moved to Whitstable in 1999. So I'm coming up to almost 20 years here. I always wanted to write crime novels. And as soon as I moved here from London, I just thought, wow, this is quintessentially crime territory. You know, we've got St. Alphege's Church, or St. Alfred's, as I've renamed it in my books. And we had Mr. Theobald at the time, the butcher. Lots of people had said walking down the high street here was almost a bit like Camberwick Green or Trumpton. But it's true. Most people know one another, and it just has so many of the essential qualities of classic whodunit crime that it was just waiting for me to explore sooner or later.
Now, it's a lovely community because you do have proper butchers here, proper, you know, bakers, no candlestick makers. But it is that community that has everything. It has all those classic locations. Peter Cushing even lived here, didn't he? So we have a master of the macabre who used to live here. Location is very important. We see authors like Rebus sticking with Edinburgh, and of course Morse is in Oxford. This is much smaller than both those places. And as you say, you said you changed the name of the church. Are you changing names to protect the innocent? It must be difficult because you don't want to start. I mean, people must start looking for themselves in the books or looking for locations. How do you balance that?
Yeah, they do, actually. And what I've done for most of the time is used actual locations and by name. But with St. Alphege Church, I changed that to St. Alfred's purely because I had decided to have a female vicar, as a bit of a surprise for the reader, miniskirted Rev Prue. and then I discovered that St. Alphege had actually got a female vicar, the lovely Rev Rachel, and I didn't want people to confuse the two in any way. So that's why I changed the name of the church.
good sensitivity there. So when you're writing about Chet, obviously you can step in there, you can walk around, you can take notes, photographs. Do you speak to the vicar? What sort of level of research do you do locally, or do you just absorb it through osmosis? You're walking down the street and you think, there's a story idea there.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think we all use different methods and means to get our inspiration. For me, location is incredibly important because I think my background is growing up in the East End of London during the 50s and 60s. It was a very bleak time and we lived in very poor accommodation, you know, literally two rooms with a tin bath out in the garden, no hot water, all of that. But essentially, we were a small, very tightly knit community. And that was the great takeaway of my upbringing. And the thing that later on led me to be very comfortable writing TV drama with EastEnders, where I was suddenly within another small community. You know, when I was growing up, nobody actually commuted to work. Everybody worked locally. And the same is true of Albert Square right now, isn't it? Nobody goes off commuting. They all work, actually, in Albert Square. So I fitted in very neatly there. And Whitstable has exactly that same quality of small community, even though it's totally distinct from the East End of London. It's still underpinned by this great sense of community here, of people knowing one another. And because of that, obviously, you know, I've got the tag of cozy crime, because that's very much something. I mean, I don't like these things because I see them as marketing labels and I try to resist them. And I think sometimes if you're labeled as a cozy crime writer, my fear is that my books will be seen purely as just Cluedo mysteries to be solved. And I like to think that they are more than that, without becoming pretentious. But certainly, you know, the location of Whitstable, it had a resonance for me as soon as I came here because of the strong community. And I think also, not only in Whitstable, the new book of mine that's coming out on June the 7th, Disappearance at All, is set all around Faversham. It's a missing persons story as well. So my main protagonist is taken on a search for a missing young man, and it leads her to various areas. But within all of them, I generally find one particular place that I know will be iconic in some way. And then I'll talk to the owner or whoever is in charge of that location. And from that, spin all these other ideas, basically.
This will be another Pearl Nolan mystery, is that correct?
That's right, yes.
So tell us about Pearl. Where did she come from? And I'm interested to know how you keep a character like that fresh book after book.
Pearl is... she comes to the reader in the first book, The Whitstable Pearl Mystery, as a woman of 39 who's facing basically empty nest syndrome. She always wanted to be a police detective and began police training as a young woman, but an unplanned pregnancy, teenage pregnancy at the age of 19, put paid to that. And so instead she remained in her hometown of Whitstable, brought up her son as a single mum, and ran a successful seafood restaurant. Very unpretentious, but noted for its seafood and especially its oysters, because of course we're in Whitstable, called the Whitstable Pearl. And so that's where the title comes from. But she, at 39, with her son Charlie away at university, Kent University, of course, which is just down the road in Canterbury, because we're here, she feels this pull of old dreams and ambitions, and she starts up a private detective agency, basically not solving the great murder mysteries that she always intended to do, but finding herself finding lost dogs, etc. But on the eve of Whitstable's famous Oyster Festival, she becomes embroiled in what is a murder mystery, but which the police feel might just be suicide or an accident. And so Pearl is then put into contact and conflict with a rather dishy police DCI from Canterbury, called Detective Mike Maguire. And Mike Maguire essentially embodies the DFL. You'll know, coming from Herne Bay yourself, the DFL is the Down From Londoner, as opposed to the native, which is what Pearl is. And of course, Pearl embodies everything native. I mean, we even have a native oyster here. And it's a clash of two worlds. But that's also the personalization of something bigger in this community, which is this essential tension between the visitors to a small little town that can change it overnight, really, into something quite distinct. Or, you know, how does a small town remain idiosyncratic and with all the things that essentially embody its attraction for visitors? It's a conundrum.
You've written sort of 5 books in about just a few years, and Pearl is in each one of these. How do you keep Pearl fresh in every one of these? What's the key to a good repeating detective character?
Well, the relationship between Pearl and Mike Maguire is an interesting one, because coming as well from having written TV drama and especially EastEnders with its eternal cliffhanger, we do have a will they won't they love affair going on that too. They're completely opposites, but you know, there's the romantic pull between them, but there's also a professional rivalry. So in each case they're becoming closer, but with each case as well, Maguire is realizing that Pearl is everything that he isn't, really. He's formal procedure and Pearl is instinctive. She's an instinctive people person. And so the drama that plays out between them is an essential part of the crime cases themselves. And that's keeping me on my toes, really.
Fantastic. Now, you've mentioned TV a few times. I can't let that slip. It says in your biography on your website that you settled into TV. I think there's more to the story than that. How did you break into TV? How did it all start for you?
I did really fall into it. I had always thought that I would write books. And I wrote short stories and had some of those published, but I always had a day job. And then I went traveling for many years and found myself bobbing around on a boat in the Mediterranean and having adventures. And when I returned to London, I started to work for a commercials company who were interested in getting into producing drama. They knew I'd written short stories, and there was something coming up for Channel 4, which was a series of 12-minute short films. And basically, there'd been a call out to new writers to write these. And so I tried adapting a short story, and it just didn't work. It, you know, it was essentially a short story and just didn't work as a, especially something that was so short. You know, 12 minutes is very little time to get a story across. So I wrote something kind of custom made for 12 minutes for Channel 4. It was a black comedy. It got made. And from that, I then, because that had been co-produced by British Screen at the time that were funding feature films, and it was made, you know, proper 35mm film with a proper budget, suddenly, you know, I'd become a mini script writer for a mini film. And I got an agent, and from there I got work in TV. So I did really fall into it. But I think it was because that 12-minute film was essentially very much a character piece. And from that, and a dialogue piece, from that then it was an easier move for me to TV, and essentially, you know, shows that I got to work on, EastEnders, London's Burning, etc., dialogue shows.
Yeah. And that's interesting, because that's the kind of thing now I could do on my phone. Mm. You know, so if you're a writer out there and you're thinking, I've got a knack for dialogue, I've got a knack for character, there's nothing to stop you shooting this on your phone and trying ideas out. I mean, obviously, you've got the validation of having it made for a TV company, what have you, but I just find that there's no better lesson than doing it, you know, and getting it wrong and then learning and getting it less wrong next time. So.
Yeah, getting it wrong, I think, is really important. Nobody should ever be disheartened by coming up with a project that doesn't work, because it's only from discovering why it doesn't work that you get better. And, you know, there are so many books these days about how to write the perfect screenplay and how to do all this. But you it doesn't matter how much theory you know, you still have to make your own mistakes and learn what you're really good at too.
I've made all the mistakes. Now, so let's talk a bit more about the crowning glory of British television, which is EastEnders. And you worked on that for quite some time, didn't you? And what were the biggest lessons that you learned from working on that show?
Oh, in one word, structure. And for me, I'd always written as a kid. I'm an only child, you know, used to entertain myself. I'd go out sometimes, you know, write stories down Roman Road Market, whatever. But I never really understood structure properly. Even when I wrote that 12-minute film, that was the thing that I had to work on more than anything else. And writing for a show like EastEnders with its own parameters really taught me a lot about structuring a story. Also, the premise, you know, that you had an audience that you could potentially lose to a cup of tea and a bacon sandwich at any time. So, you know, we would always have to put a hook at the end of every scene and a cliffhanger at the end of every episode to keep those readers watching. And that was really important. So the transition to writing books is something that I've taken all that with me. And, you know, my chapters usually end in a hook, and the books usually end in some kind of a cliffhanger, even if it just involves the relationship between Pearl and Maguire. But structure was really important for me, because I think that there are many, many great writers out there. There are many people with a fantastic ear for dialogue. There are people who know and understand a good story, but somehow when they come to write their own stories, they get lost in the middle. They find themselves falling down that plug hole. And I've often said, you know, whenever I've talked to young writers, to give them any hints I possibly can, just consider your story as a sheet on a washing line. You know, you wouldn't leave it all baggy in the middle. It would just get blown away. So remember to put in those pegs at regular points. And
I love that you think that students do their own washing.
Yeah, wishful thinking, maybe.
So they go, what? Sheets? I just drop it off at my mum's. What?
True.
And so, I mean, the moral of the story is live in fear of the cup of tea and the bacon sandwich, isn't it? They live in fear of losing your audience. I mean, we've, on EastEnders, I believe you worked with John York, who we've had on the show, and he's very big on structure and hooks and that sort of thing. Did you get to work with John much on the show?
Yes, I did. It was fantastic. I always loved John. When I started on the show, he was a script editor. Then he went on to storylining. He had a cupboard full of various storylines of, you know, that writers had sent in, and he'd keep in a cupboard. And then he went up to executive level. And as I recall, I think John was in charge when we went to 3 episodes a week and then 4. At the time I began, we were only going out twice a week. And that was great, because in those days, in the early 90s, there were probably more comedy writers than anything on the show. Which seems, you know, a bit odd to, for people nowadays to know. But I was basically more of a comedy writer than a straight writer. And I think some of the storylines, they required some humour. Obviously, you know, the light and shade. And as it went on, of course, it became very difficult to manage the show, I think. I think John would say that too, because it was like turning a tank around. If something went wrong, you know, or if one of the actors suddenly weren't available, it was a huge heroic effort, you know. It would be quite possible to write 2 episodes or 3 episodes as a single writer in any week, not encounter any continuity problems. But once you had 4, you know, you would break up the workload, and then we'd have to be talking to one another all the time on the phone, saying, "Have you started your episode yet?" And then I'd find that the guy that was sharing the week's episodes with me had actually finished his weeks before and was now enjoying life, you know, sunbathing in the garden. I never quite managed to do that. I always took it to the wire. But John was brilliant. And then, he moved around quite a bit, you know, in other channels. And he did, you know, ask me to write something for him later on as well. We never got it made, but it was nice to be asked.
Yeah. It's interesting because you always, in modern TV, they talk about the writer's room. There'll be a showrunner in the room. There'll be a bunch of writers sitting around the table cracking the story. So that wasn't the case on EastEnders. You were on the phone to each other. You were at a remove. Is that right?
No, we would have an initial conference. We would have storyline conferences that maybe took place once or twice a year, where the kind of general storylining would be discussed of where we would be going with various characters for the whole year. And then there would be a monthly conference where we would be discussing the storylines for that month, which were divvied up between however many writers. And we would then maybe put forward changes or suggestions, and then that draft document would become the final document. But in the course of going away and writing your episode, you'd come across all sorts of problems, or you know often we'd repeat ourselves, and so we'd have to iron all that out too, especially if you had a very complex police investigation, for example, things like that, or medical. So you'd always have to check with the person that was behind or in front of you. It was like Chinese whispers. We used to have some really great writers' conferences when I first started on the show, because in those days, it was in the days where you could smoke at the BBC in the conference room, and they would even put on booze for you, which was a very dangerous thing to do. About 35 writers, some of whom were a bit stressed from writing too many episodes. I could tell some stories about those, yeah. But it was great fun. And then it became much more puritanical and work-oriented.
Oh, no fun anymore. So while this is going on, you're writing EastEnders, you're writing another TV shows as well, you're learning more and more about structure. Were there novel ideas? Were you writing novels? Were you working on new ideas? Or did there come a point where you thought, now I'm ready, I'm going to stop doing this, I'm going to start doing that? How did the transition come about for you?
I had a break at one point where I'd had a kind of unfinished novel on the back burner for many years, and it kept changing. And it was actually... It had a female heroine, but it wasn't really a crime novel. It was called Sex Crimes, and it was about a woman trying to split up with this guy. And I only wrote one draft of it. My agent sent it off to some publishers, and it came back with this extraordinary thing. So we really love it, but it's too literary fiction to be chick lit, and it's too chick lit to be literary fiction. So I left that firmly on the back burner, and then just concentrated on TV for some time. And then I always had, when I was bobbing around on that yacht in the Med, trying to learn to sail properly, that was in the 80s, there was a very dark, stormy night in which the captain of the yacht said to me, right, we need to cast the anchor overboard, but be careful, make sure you don't put your foot into the coiled anchor chain before you do so, or you'll go over with it. And it was such a horrendous thought to me in this dark, oily water at the time, that one could do that, that you could make a mistake on a dark night, step into the bite of this anchor chain, throw the anchor overboard and go with it, and that would be it. That image stuck with me, and that's what I used for the first book. So in many ways, although I knew that I did want to write about Whitstable as a location, there are all these other little things. I always knew that I did want to write about this strong, independent woman who was making her own way, but who had unresolved ambitions. But all those smaller things, they're really the stuff of screenplays, aren't they? And I think, I think very much in terms of images when I write rather than words.
It's fascinating to me, going back to what you're saying about these labels, the chick lit and the literary, which bizarrely sounds like books like Gone Girl, which sell so brilliantly now, who have that great literary strength to them, but have... I don't like the phrase chick lit. I don't even know what it means, but you've written a novel. I mean, this idea of having a half-finished novel is going to be very familiar to a lot of the people listening to this, and then putting it out, then having it rejected. And were you ever despondent? Did you ever think this isn't? How were you at that point? Did you ever hit a kind of a low, or is just rejection just part of the game? I mean, as a screenwriter, you'll probably know about that.
Yeah, I think it just is part of the game. Some people obviously are very lucky. They might hit success first time. But I sent lots of things off in brown paper envelopes to editors and what have you, whether they were short stories or whatnot. And the majority of them were rejected. But when you do get a bit of success, the important thing is to try and, after you've stopped with the excitement and stop pinching yourself, is then just to try and do some more good work so that you capitalize on it. And, you know, for me, writing this series, I had a lot of unfinished novels in terms of writing a crime series. And I think that was because I just didn't have the right characters. Because we've talked about location and we've talked about the inspiration of setting and also, you know, really the inciting incident, you call it in screenplay writing, you know, that anchor chain, somebody going over the board, overboard with their anchor chain. But actually, it's having those characters, knowing that you are going to spend an awful lot of time with these characters. And if you get bored by them, you can't expect any readers to be interested. They're going to give up and go off and have that bacon sandwich by chapter two. So for me, it was really knowing who it was that I wanted to write about. And for a long time, I thought that I wanted a male detective. And then I recognized it was a woman, but there was a male counterpart too. So I've got two for the price of one. The other thing, though, is that a lot of cozy crime is very popular for amongst women, but I do have male readers too, and I think that is because of the choir, which is great.
Now, these wonderful Whitstable mysteries, there's some good news about these concerning TV. Is that something you can talk about now?
Yeah, well, they have been optioned by a very good production company. And I do believe there's a pilot script having been written. It's almost finished. And things are looking positive. But, you know, these deals are very slippery. And so you can't talk too much. You know, it's like counting your chickens before they're even laid. So it's a difficult one. But I've got everything crossed at the moment, which is why I keep falling over, Mark.
Now, you weren't tempted to write this yourself, but then you've got more novels to write. So, I mean, were you ever tempted to write the TV pilot, or were you happy to hand it over?
I was really happy to hand it over, because coming from such a long period of time writing TV drama, it was a real luxury for me to begin writing books, and also to have the autonomy over my story that I really didn't have working in a long-running TV series. I loved writing for EastEnders and all the other shows that I did write for, but they were characters that were already there, and all I could do was just bring my voice to them and the story that they were playing out. The books were great because suddenly, you know, I've got a fantastic publishing director too in Christina Green. She was originally at Constable and Robinson, which then became Constable Books, and they're now with Little Brown. And she, compared to the notes that I used to get for an episode of TV drama, which would start, you know, page one, line one, can we just possibly do this or that? I mean, I probably get, I don't know, just some general notes. And although sometimes she may have had doubts about the ending, there have been good doubts to raise, and they've made the endings better. But we work really as a partnership. She gives me really a lot of free rein with the story, so that's been brilliant. So the idea of going back to writing a TV script, even if it was for my own show, wasn't one that I really relished. I'm really happy writing the books, and I absolutely feel that for a pilot episode, it would be great to give to a writer who can bring something fresh to it.
Well, it's worked for so many other writers. Disappearance and All is out soon, or probably might even be out now when you're listening to it. So congratulations on that and the series so far. We're going to enjoy the weather here. The sun has actually come out here. The tide is coming in a bit. Might get an ice cream. What do you think, Julie?
That sounds very good. We might even get a drink because we're not very far away from the old Neptune pub.
Oh, lovely. Julie, thank you so much for speaking to me today.
Thank you so much, Mike. It's an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Julie, for that conversation. It was brilliant to speak to you. And yes, her new book, The Disappearance at Oare, which is O-A-R-E, which is a place near Faversham, is out on 7th of June. So do please check it out on all the backlist too. They're really, really good fun. Oh, and just to explain to American friends, we mentioned a couple of TV shows there, Camberwick Green and Trumpton. Just to reassure you, Trumpton is not an animated children's show about the world ruled by Donald Trump. It's quite a charming, adorable show about a very old-fashioned village called Trumpton, Trump, T-O-N. And certainly for people of a certain age, my age, we hold it in very, very deep affection. Anyway, just wanted to get that one in. So do come and speak to us on social media. We're on Facebook at Bestseller Experiment, on Twitter and Instagram at Bestseller XP. And I'm about to revamp our Pinterest page as well. So if you've got a novel and you've got some beautiful artwork that you want to show off to the world, you can put it up on our Pinterest board for listeners who've had their books published. So drop us a line. Come and speak to us at bestsellerexperiment@gmail.com and we'll pop it up there for you. And don't forget to buy our book, Back to Reality, which is still available on Kindle. There will be a paperback one day, I promise. Honestly, we'll sort that out. And thanks to everyone who's left a review as well. We love reading them. We love knowing what you think. And please subscribe, rate and review on iTunes. We've got some fantastic interviews coming up. I've got quite a backlog at the moment. We've got some really, really good stuff coming. And there's some really cool stuff coming for our Patreon supporters as well. Do pop over to patreon.com/bestseller experiment. And you can get all sorts of fun extras there. So do check it out. Thanks for listening. And until next time, happy writing.